supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. From WHYY in Philadelphia, I am your host, Mike McGrath, and we got a jam-packed show for you this week, Cats and Kittens. In the question of the week, we will examine whether warm season grasses like Bermuda are gaining the upper hand on cool season grasses like fescue as everyone's winters get warmer. We're also going to get learned by the Delaware Center for Horticulture how to turn abandoned lots fairly easily into drive-by flower shows. It's a lot to get done. We better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Laura, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Laura. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I'm really excited. I'm a longtime listener, first-time caller.
So. Okay. And where is Laura excited?
So I'm calling you from Ardmore, Pennsylvania, just outside of the city.
All right. What can we do for Laura in Ardmore?
I'm a realtor in the Philadelphia suburbs of the Main Line, and I find myself sharing your wisdom to advise clients on, you know, how to stage their homes and spruce up their gardens during the spring and summer. So first, I just wanted to say thank you so much for your advice. But my question comes about because my fiance and I just finished rehabbing a home and we missed the deadline to put down sod. So our front lawn is looking a little bit sad right now.
Yeah, it's a bad time of year to try to do anything with a lawn. And let me tell you something that might blow our listeners' minds, but I am a regular guest on another radio program called Real Estate Today. They actually have me on four times a year to tell people how to get instant curb appeal in a house that needs to be sold. So I actually do a lot of this kind of work. One thing I would warn you against is when you're laying sod, one of the most important things is you want it to be fresh. And the best sod is going to be available in the springtime. My understanding is you can get sod in the fall, but it's harder to find. It may have been sitting around longer, and you might have to pay more. It might actually even have to be custom cut for you. Now, if you could arrange a cut just to your specifications, that would be an amazingly perfectly fresh sod. But, it, you know, I'm thinking there would be a real premium price attached to it, whereby you can arrange to have really good quality sod delivered and installed in the spring. But go ahead, tell me what you want to do.
So last weekend, Chris and I were at a garden center and we saw some of those potted smaller pine trees.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were debating if we could even plant pine trees or something like that, like a tree that thrives in the wintertime still, or should we just put them out front, leave them in their pots until spring?
And first one. Even a plant that's rated for a much lower growing zone than you can't really be sitting out in a pot because the roots are just going to freeze instantly. Whereby, okay, if you don't want to plant them specifically, but the soil isn't frozen yet, you can dig a hole and drop the pot into the hole. Believe it or not, just that like foot and a half of depth, depending on the size of the pot, getting those roots down below the worst of the frost will be the difference between life and death. Guaranteed, if you leave them out in their pots, they're going to die over the winter. Dropped into the ground, they're absolutely going to survive, whether you actually plant them or drop them into their pots. It's not a lot of work to just drop the pots in the ground on the next nice day.
Great. Okay, well, we'll definitely do that then.
Yeah, and then, again, arrange the sod for the spring well in advance. Talk to garden centers now, because you know a lot of garden centers are going to close down after the holidays. So you want to talk to them now and find out what kind of sod they offer you. I would recommend turf-type tall fescue. You can get bluegrass if you want. Different places will supply different types of sod. And you want to be ready to have that sod professionally installed the day it comes into the garden center or landscaper.
Okay, great. I'll definitely share that with my clients who are planning to, you know, start sprucing up their houses in the spring to sell too. I really appreciate it.
The first 24 hours is when the sod is going to look the best forever, getting it in the ground.
Great. Okay.
All right. Well, thank you, Laura. Good question for this time of year. Good luck to you.
All right. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. John, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
I am just ducky today, John. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
And where's John doing well?
I am from Marlton, New Jersey.
Very good. The Garden State. What can we do for you, sir?
Sure. Mike, I work as an administrator in a nearby school district.
Mm-hmm.
About 6 years ago, our district turned over the maintenance and operations of the landscape beds that immediately surround our school to a committee that turned them into rain gardens. Now, as a school, we fully supported this idea from an environmental perspective.
Uh-huh.
However, aesthetically speaking, the gardens just look absolutely awful. And from a maintenance perspective, you know, we cannot distinguish between what are purposeful plants or weeds, and there is really no mulch, but rather whole leaves that are spread on top of the entire beds themselves.
And they're not shredded?
Not shredded, dumped in whole. Now, the Rain Garden Committee assures us that this is how it's supposed to be done.
No.
We get a lot of public complaints about the appearance of the garden.
Yeah, the public is right.
The question really is there a better way to be doing this?
It doesn't sound like there's a worse way, does there?
They look terrible.
Rain gardens are a wonderfully environmentally sound way to deal with areas that have poor drainage that can't be easily rectified and or areas of high rainfall. To introduce a rain garden into an area where water is not a problem kind of makes you scratch your head. I mean,
right.
I can see it. If there's like a learning area, the botanic garden for demonstration and stuff, but not to jury rig it because it was the popular trend in gardening 6 years ago, which sounds like what happened. Somebody has to wrest control from this committee and ask them what their sources are. Throwing the whole leaves in there, for instance, is right away, no, you never do that. That smothers plants. Actually, it's nature's way of making sure that trees get all the nutrients on the forest floor. When they drop their leaves, they smother most of the low growth in the forest, which is why forest floor is often bare except for leaf litter and the roots of trees. So it's not conducive to plant growth. It's like putting a tarp over the things for the winter. So somebody here is not thinking things through or not working from good sources. Now, the first thing I want you to do, go to our website, go to youbetyourgarden.org, click on Garden Answers A to Z, and go to R for rain gardens. We did a nice little article on rain gardens when they were super hot, like 4 or 6 years ago. And in that article are click-throughs to various extension service articles that kind of take you through the breadth of rain gardens, because there's all different types. The most successful of which, for instance, have a bog or a pond in the center with bog and pond plants in there. And then they have what are called marginal plants on the outskirts of the bog. And then they have dry plants on the outside. And, you know, you direct the water from gutters and stuff to make sure the bog or the pond stays relatively wet. And it's a way of managing excess stormwater. It's a great way to purify water. But if it's just a hodgepodge of ideas, it's not doing any good. And you want something to look good outside the school. Now, if you want to bag the whole concept of the rain gardens, and you say there's a bunch of them, right?
Yeah, I mean, we're an entire block, so it's pretty much every garden on the entire block that surrounds our school.
Yeah, maybe make a deal, because there are some excellent plantings that can be worked into the school curriculum. But people have to remember that in the Northeast and the Midwest and stuff, the school season and the main gardening season are separate. But if you wanted to take one of these rain gardens and try something different, I would take out the plantings that are in there and not use mulch, but just compost. And then as soon as school starts, have literally thousands of daffodil bulbs, at least like a dozen for each kid, depending on the size of the school. But have the teachers show the kids these bulbs and cut some of them open to show the kids that there's already a flower inside. The flower is already grown, and it's just going to sleep over the winter. Then the kids can go outside into this bed. They can plant their daffodils, maybe do some signage to show where theirs are planted. And in the spring, long before school is over, the daffodils will come up and flower. The kids can go out, cut their daffodils down, and take them back home and put them on the dining room table. So then they've seen a sequence of growth. And after the green growth of the daffodil leaves dies down, if you want to plant annual flowers out there for the summer, that's fine. Or then you could just mulch the bed if you want low care over the summer. But there's a number of plants like that, pansies, that would look good all fall, winter, and spring, but they would die off in the summer, which is fine. It's when the kids aren't there. Garlic, the kids could plant their own garlic cloves on the first day of school and harvest beautiful heads of garlic to take home on the last day of school. That's going to be much more informative to them and breed future gardeners than something that was supposed to be a good idea that doesn't look good in front of the school.
I think these are great ideas. Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, and when you go to look up rain gardens, go to S for School Gardens, because I've listed all the ideas that I think make sense in cool weather climates.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
All right, good luck, John.
All right, take care.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind all the men out there that a male who brings holly into the house at this time of year will rule the roost for the coming year, unless the female of the household brings ivy indoors beforehand. But don't go running outside with those pruners just yet, guys, because we'll be right back to decorate abandoned lots, ask what's so bad about Bermuda, and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show is climate change and the warmer winters we've been experiencing helping plants like Bermuda grass thrive and push out cool season plants like fescue. We'll examine that burning question, especially burning in July and August, and see what we can do about it. We'll also take lots more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it is time to welcome our special guest today, Vikram Krishnamurti, who is the executive director of the Delaware Center for Horticulture. And as somebody who lives in the Philadelphia area, I can tell you that the DCH is always making news. Vic is here to talk to us about what they are doing with abandoned spaces and growing interesting plants in them. Vic, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thanks, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here. Yeah, we are a nonprofit organization based in Wilmington. We're celebrating our 40th year of community greening this year, so we're really excited about that. Some of our newest work involves, as you mentioned, vacant spaces and vacant land in Wilmington. So there's a lot happening in Wilmington with rejuvenating and revitalizing vacant properties, and a lot of those properties are vacant lots. So this particular partnership that I'm here to talk about today was one with our state of Delaware Department of Natural Resources. There is an air quality monitoring station along Martin Luther King Boulevard that is otherwise an open lot. And it's an important gateway to the city of Wilmington. Our Department of Natural Resources approached us about doing something creative there. And it's the first project that we have been involved in to create an urban meadow. So we're excited about the plant selection there. We're excited about how this project came together and the community involvement that was involved in it as well.
I know the gateway you're talking about. I play the Chase Center most springs, and when I get off of I-95, that's exactly where I go down, and I'll be looking to see some glorious plants there this
spring.
That's
great. Yep, it's right along the Amtrak station is there, so it's really important in terms of visitors to Wilmington, public perception, and beautification.
And, you know, it's funny because I think now of the Philadelphia airport, of some train stations I've seen around the country. These are areas that were often never planted or neglected. And the difference, for instance, PHS, the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society, they've done some plantings on the way to the airport. And, you know, they're not that huge or anything, but they make such a huge difference that you're not seeing just the scrapyards and the crusher. You know,
exactly. And we are very similar. We do very similar work to PHS. We work with them as well. And you're absolutely right. You know, these areas do present some challenges, certainly, in terms of the soil conditions, other challenges of the urban environment. But this meadow planting is one in particular that provides not only color, but benefits to pollinators. And it's low maintenance as well. So that's another thing we're really excited about as well, because maintenance of these spaces can be a challenge.
Okay, so there's a lot of things I want to talk about here that are going to be adaptable to every part of the country. Everybody has vacant lots. Everybody has some gateway from the train station or the airport that, you know, either looks plain or brutal. But you brought up an interesting subject, one I try to talk about a lot, and sometimes I don't get around to it as often as I should, and that's the incredible dangers posed by urban soils. I presume you went into this project assuming that the soil was like 30% lead.
Exactly. And it is definitely an issue in Wilmington. We have a lot of community gardening programs and support over 40 community gardens throughout Newcastle County in Delaware. And that's one of the first criteria that we work with in terms of supporting community gardening efforts is, you know, soil safety is the absolute first consideration that anyone gardening should take into consideration.
And let's be clear here, because I think people misunderstand this. You can always get the wrong answer if you frame the debate incorrectly. They're always worried about eating lead in their string beans. And the danger is just working with the soil. Every time you disturb the soil, the lead goes into the air, it gets on your skin. That's 100 times bigger personal danger than eating a tomato that was grown in unremediated soil.
Correct. And there are different approaches depending on what you're growing, but you're absolutely right in terms of the real immediate threat and consideration is how you are working in the soil, how deep you are digging. Lead is one of several heavy metals that, you know, we're concerned about in terms of releasing those into the ambient air.
You know, because it's important to talk about plant selection. It's important to talk about, you know, who you work in tandem with. As you said, your Department of Environmental Resources in Delaware, getting a partner like that can mean $1 million. But isn't the first step before you do anything else getting a stupid, simple heavy metal soil sample test?
Absolutely. And the other consideration, and it's represented in the type of planting and the type of project that this is, the maintenance considerations. So for longer term and ongoing maintenance, we want to disturb that soil as little as possible. So that has really dictated the type of project that this became, because, you know, a meadow planting really involves mowing once a year, and the rest of the year those plants grow. They have some four-season interest. They provide color. They provide benefits to pollinators. But the real key here is that it's a minimal maintenance that also minimizes the amount of soil disturbance that we do throughout the year.
Did you do anything in the beginning? Did you make sure everybody was wearing gloves and respirators?
Absolutely. Some of the first initial, during the testing phase and also initial assessment phase of the site, those were certainly considerations. And then the big consideration for us as a community-based organization, we had volunteers from a local corporation that helped with the planting and supported our staff in completing the planting. So those considerations were absolutely important ones in terms of the safety of volunteers as well. And in planting in urban areas, you have to also worry about traffic. So, you know, whether it relates to lane closures, high visibility, you know, safety vests, those kinds of things are all things that go into the mix in terms of doing this type of work.
Yeah, but let me beat this horse a little bit more.
Sure. Just
because, you know, we're in Philadelphia where the Horticultural Society has remediated Lord knows how many vacant lots, pop-up gardens, community gardens, little showplace gardens, and in Delaware, and people are thinking, oh, sure, inner city, it's all polluted. But there is no urban area in America where there isn't going to be a lot of lead and other nasty stuff in the soil. Oklahoma, Dayton, up in Seattle, I don't care where you are. If there were houses there and old cars there, there's going to be lead in the soil.
Yep, absolutely. And Wilmington in particular, with an industrial history, even more so. And even within Wilmington, there are certain areas that are more impacted than others historically.
Yeah, and you talk about train stations.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, you know, creosote.
Areas around train stations are all brown fields.
Mm-hmm. Yep. The nice thing for us in this project in working with, I'll refer to them as DENREC, but our Department of Natural Resources, was that because this was an already existing site that they used for air quality monitoring, we didn't have the level of soil testing and, you know, that we otherwise would need to do, which we have done in several areas around Wilmington for other projects. For example, you know, a house that is demolished once condemned, that can be turned into productive use, and, you know, especially providing green space for a neighborhood. That kind of starting from scratch is much different and requires a much more thorough testing process than we needed to undertake for this already existing site.
Because they had tested it.
Exactly.
Okay, so you had the old information. Lead doesn't change.
That's right.
But, you know, it's interesting because you say you're growing a lot of meadow plants, and we'll talk about a couple of names pretty soon, and you mow them once a year. But this is one technique of soil remediation, is you grow plants that absorb lots of the heavy metals as opposed to plants that don't take them up. And then you collect those mowings and you don't compost them or anything like that. Theoretically, you bury them or burn them or something.
Yep.
Because,
absolutely,
you know, the lead will survive anything. Lead's going to be the last thing to go.
Yep.
So what have you and your research found to be both easy care, four-season interest, and to look as good as you hoped it would?
Absolutely. And this is key because along with those properties for soil remediation, the other nice thing about certain plant selections is that they will perform well in poor soils. All of our urban plantings place a priority on low water requirements. So, you know, this is the kind of planting that once established, we won't really need to provide supplemental watering beyond the initial establishment period. So certainly a lot of grasses, things like switchgrass, panicum, virgatum, carex species, so sedges also work well.
Is it my impression, am I wrong, but sedges seem to be like under the radar, but getting like burning hot in the world of horticulture?
We think that they're underutilized. You know, one of the things that I really like about sedges is that, you know, this site, for example, has high exposure to sun, wind, etc. There are certain species of sedges that will do really well in those hot, sunny, and dry conditions. And then you also have species within this and varieties within the same genus that will perform well in dry shade, moist shade. So it's a really adaptable genus of plants for various purposes. Switchgrass as well is another one that has been very successful and continues to experience an explosion of new varieties and new selections, whether for color, height, size, performance. You know, some are more upright, others are more sprawling depending on the soil conditions, things like that. So the grasses in this planting are primarily switchgrass and sedges. And then, you know, in terms of supporting pollinators in, you know, other
we need some flowers in here.
Exactly. So in other complementary ways, things like a variety of milkweeds, including the butterfly weed,
mm-hmm,
some coneflower that will do well on the site as well.
And be pretty.
Exactly. You know, there's so many new varieties and selections of coneflower as well. So it's not just the light purple or the white anymore, of course. You know, there are yellows and oranges and reds that are really doing well.
And attracting a lot of butterflies and native bees.
Exactly. Yep. And then other things like, you know, that might not necessarily catch your eye at first, but things like Joe Pye weed. You know,
which is the native plant, right?
Exactly.
That's like the poster child.
Exactly. Again, a lot of new varieties. We work very closely with North Creek Nursery that develops. They're located in Landenburg. They develop a number of new plant selections.
And, Landenburg, PA.
Exactly. You know, there are several Joe Pye weeds now that have a variety of sizes. And,
I'll tell you what. Let's start a trend. Let's try to change the name to Joe Pye plant.
Sure. Yeah, we could do that for butterfly weed as well.
Because I can remember the late Bob Rodale when he was trying to get farmers out in Lancaster County to grow out different types of amaranth for him.
Mm-hmm.
They go, you can't pay us to grow a weed.
That's right. But yet it's called a weed because it's so easy to grow.
And, you know, talk about a plant that looks dramatic when it's got that big flower head and the seeds start to form and everything.
Absolutely. And so, that's a good example of the multiple season interest as well for these plantings, because we don't want to be going in there and changing out plants on a seasonal basis. So the plant selection, whether it relates to color, texture, the ornamental grasses in the fall and winter get their plumes. So, you know, it provides a lot of year-round interest in a way that minimizes the amount of disturbance and, frankly, the cost for going back in and doing seasonal plantings that you might otherwise do.
And I presume you're mowing these places down kind of low about 2 weeks after everything starts growing again in the spring?
Absolutely. Yep. And really, that's it.
So, obviously, these things are kind of show gardens. They're tall, they're full, they're meant to be enjoyed at a distance. Did you get any pushback on making them more of a park, having lanes for people to walk through and sit down?
Not really. It actually is pretty convenient to a pedestrian sidewalk along Martin Luther King Boulevard. We have some other plantings along that whole stretch of that roadway. And, you know, people have responded well from the pedestrian standpoint of being able to look at things up close. But the real consideration for us was also basically because it is a prime commuting route into Wilmington, as you mentioned, what is the perception of drivers? And so that did affect the planting plan to a certain degree.
Right. You need tall. You need color.
You need things in mass. So we planted large groupings of things as opposed to, you know, individualized plant selections, that kind of thing.
And especially in the inner city, you really don't need to enter the area to get the medical benefits. We know just walking past a tree will lower people's blood pressure, improve their mood, you know, change the levels of their stress hormones.
Absolutely. And that's what we are all about as an organization. Our mission is that we inspire individuals and communities through the power of plants. And by the power of plants, we mean, you know, plants have an ability benefits that go beyond beautification and really can affect people's lives on an everyday basis. So we really work to build an appreciation for plants. We really feel that horticulture and plants have a place for everyone, and everyone has a place for a plant. So
being based here in Philadelphia, I've been keeping an eye on the Delaware Center for Horticulture for quite a while now. And I have to congratulate you guys because you always seem to be punching above your weight.
Thank you. We are a small organization. We have a great staff. I think we have a great mix of strengths and talents and experience. And we're, you know, frankly, involved in a lot of different types of projects. So we have a really diverse set of programs, anything from youth education to job skills training in horticulture and landscaping for returning citizens to urban greening. And we're currently right now really engaged with the city of Wilmington and some concentrated efforts with our new mayor in some priorities that he has for particular West Center City neighborhood of Wilmington and the impact that greening can have in the inner city.
You and I both know that having a little park, or especially a community garden in a neighborhood, instantly raises the property values.
Absolutely. We're also having a lot of success through these vacant land efforts with new collaborations with affordable housing partners. So I think in the affordable housing community development community, there's a new awareness and an increased awareness in the benefits of incorporating green spaces as part of any new home building project, especially for areas of the city where green space may be at a premium.
You keep talking about something that I think is really important about the value of partnerships. that you're not trying to reinvent the wheel by yourself. You've mentioned the Department of Natural Resources in Delaware, the Housing Authority. I look around the country and sometimes I don't see people making these connections, but it has to make the job twice as easy if you have a partner and three times as easy if there's three of you in there.
It's really one of our core values as an organization is, and partly because we are small, we can't do all that we do ourselves. We really, you know, and it extends not just to organizational partners and other agencies, but it's really represented in the way that we work with volunteers as well. So businesses large and small in Wilmington, you know, whether it's a corporate team building effort or neighborhood volunteers that are getting together and ways that we can support their efforts. Volunteerism is really a key way that we extend our capacity as an organization as well.
And you may well be a small organization, but I can tell you, keeping an eye on you, that you're having a really big impact in the Wilmington area.
Thank you, Mike.
So anybody who wants to learn more about what the Delaware Center for Horticulture does and maybe make contact with them or see some examples of their projects, you're at dch.org, correct?
The DCH.org.
You're like the flower show in Philly. It's not the Philadelphia Flower Show online. It's
theflowershow.org. Right.
No others need apply, right? All right, so that's thedch.org. And we'd like to thank Vikram Krishnamurti, the director of the DCH, for coming in and speaking with us today. Good job, sir.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody who's getting a cut tree this Christmas to have a bow saw at the ready at home. Cut an extra inch off the bottom of the stump when you get that tree back to the house, and then plunge that cut stump into a big bucket of plain water for 24 hours before you set the tree up. And be ready to replenish that water. A dry tree can suck up gallons, and that'll keep your carpets from being a carpet of needles. But don't you go tucking away that tinsel just yet, because we'll be right back to bolt to Bermuda and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will examine a burning question that may touch upon climate change. It seems warm season grasses like Bermuda are getting the upper hand on cool season grasses like fescue. Can anything be done, and when can you do it? We'll answer those questions after we answer a couple more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Mike, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being had, Mike. How are you, sir?
I am good.
And where is Mike good?
I am in Saratoga.
Saratoga. Okay, so that's by Pottstown in Pennsylvania, right?
Yes, I'm between Pottstown and Limerick.
All right, what can we do for Mike in Saratoga?
Well, my girlfriend and I just bought our house in July. Late August, early September, I was going through the yard trying to get things ready for the winter. And I have a nice sugar maple in my side yard. And the thing was covered with these weird-looking bugs. And turns out I was there for some research. They're called spotted lantern flies.
Oh,
looking through and going through the departments at the state and U.S. Department of Ag, I was doing some research on them. And I'd like to talk a little more about it, or maybe so I can get your input on them.
Yeah, you're at the epicenter. I believe this insect was first discovered in the Hereford Huff's Church area, which is, I don't know, about 30 miles north of you.
Yeah.
It's been spread by people. The insect lays its eggs on, like, the wheel wells of their car. So when they go to visit a friend, the eggs hatch, and the insect has now spread its territory. Moving firewood is one of the ways that researchers feel this insect is spreading slowly throughout that part of southeastern Pennsylvania. And I saw my first one this past summer. I was out leaving my house, turned around, and on my screen door, I mean, it looks like a circus clown, right? It's almost an impossibly bizarre-looking insect. It's got all these colored spots. It's highly distinctive. You saw a whole bunch of the adults, right?
The sugar maple neck, the side of the house, is probably about 30 feet tall. This thing had thousands of them on it. I've since then killed probably, hopefully, 90% of them.
Yeah. When I was away on vacation this summer, I got calls from neighbors who said that they had found them on quote, the tree of heaven, the Allianthus tree, which is a weed tree that came over from Asia, as did these insects. And they said they couldn't see the tree anymore, that there were so many of them on it, and they wanted to know what to do. And I said, well, luckily, it's a tree of no use and of no importance, so cut the tree down and immediately burn it. And they couldn't believe they were talking to me because I hate outdoor burning. But in this case, that's the recommended treatment. And then keep your eyes out for the eggs, which are laid in clusters, little white eggs. And people in this area of Pennsylvania should look up the lantern fly and look at what it looks like and what the egg clusters look like. Because after I killed the one on my front steps, I went around to the back of the house and I found a cluster of its eggs. And they were hard to get off the house. I had to scrape them off with a single-edged razor blade.
I've been trying to kill them. I don't want to use poisons, but the stuff I've been using around the house has been working. Just worried about stressing out my maple tree.
Well, you might as well tell me what you've been using.
Well, 91% rubbing alcohol in a spray bottle.
Oh.
Spraying a direct raid on them.
Oh, that's
spraying
interesting.
Direct raid on them. They drop. Well, most insects breathe through their skin, so that an old exterminator taught me that trick.
Oh, okay. That's perfectly all right. What I can suggest to you now, if you want to save the maple, which is a beautiful tree, I would either treat it myself or have it treated with dormant oil. This is an organic product. It is petroleum-based. It's used to protect fruit trees in the winter. And you spray the tree, and it will smother the insect's eggs.
Yeah.
As we get into the warmer season when the trees are more vulnerable, you could switch to what's called a summer spray. That's a light vegetable-based oil that does the same thing as your rubbing alcohol is doing. It smothers them. But these are professional formulations that are really good at spraying evenly and sticking to the pests.
Then it shouldn't hurt the sugar maple then.
Absolutely not. Horticultural oils have been used for over a century to protect fruit trees. Dormant oil in the winter and a light summer spray in the summer. That might be the best response to these creatures. And obviously, you know, seek out and destroy their egg clusters. But as you see, they're very distinctive. They look like, you know, you could almost call them clown flies or something. They look
they're very weird. They're a couple shades of grayish brown, and they have black spots on them. When they open their wings up, they're fiery red inside.
Yeah, no, they're crazy looking. People in the Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware area should become familiar with them. And my experience seems to have been unusual in that I saw a single one. All of my neighbors have told me they found trees that are just covered with them, like your experience.
Like I said, just moving in, I have a bunch of vegetables I want to plant. I have some grapevines and fig trees. Bushes, and I don't want to do those until I make sure I get this under some sort of control.
I believe, if I remember correctly, and it's been a while since I read the bulletin, you might want to hold off on the grapevines because they are a fruit pest.
Yeah, I'm going to.
But they're not going to be attracted to anything in your vegetable garden.
Thanks. The other things I was using to spray them also was hairspray and dish soap, a little bit of dish soap in the water.
Don't do that. The hairspray is probably toxic. And there's a very fine line between insecticidal soap and herbicidal soap. So that's why I'm directing you to commercially made oils. They're guaranteed not to harm the plant. The home remedy thing, that gets out of hand real fast.
Yeah, well, Saturday we had all that rain, so I went out Friday night, and what few I could find that were still alive, I sprayed them with the dish soap, and I figured with all the extra heavy rain, it would wash everything away.
If you really feel a need to spray them with a home remedy, do what I do to get near a yellow jacket nest. Spray them with PAM, non-stick cooking oil. That's just a variation of the horticultural oils we were talking about.
All right, sounds good. I'll look them up, and I'll make some inquiries into them.
Okay. All right, good luck, sir.
All right, thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Jeff, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, thanks, Mike. How are you doing?
I am just ducky today, Jeff. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great, thanks.
And where is Jeff doing great?
I'm doing great in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Beer City, USA.
All right. What can we do for Jeff?
Well, I bought a whole bunch of, I call them welfare perennials at one of the big box stores. At the end of the season, they super discount them. And I don't really know where I want to put them quite yet. I just bought a house, and so I've been kind of doing some re-landscaping. And I didn't know if I could leave those in the pots sitting out. I kind of feel like probably I need to put them in the ground or bury them under some leaves or something so that they survive the winter.
Right. Now, I'll tell you a secret, Jeff. If you saw them knocked down that much, they would have been on an even bigger sale in the dumpster the next week if you'd just gone behind them.
All right.
So here's what you do. You just find an area where the soil is still workable. Mm. You dig some holes into the soil, and you drop the pots down into the soil, pots and all. And just make sure the soil line of the pot is the same once they're buried. And that's really all you need to do. You can't leave them out in the open because their roots would certainly freeze solid above the frost zone like that.
Okay. Yeah, I figured I had to put them in the ground or something.
Yeah, we used to suggest like rolling them against the side of the house and covering them with shredded leaves. But, you know, that really invites mice and voles to come and get at them underneath that protection, whereby if legitimate garden centers who are going to try to carry as many of these plants over and start them over again in the spring, they're going to do exactly what I'm suggesting, which is called healing in. I don't know where the expression came from, but if you don't sell it, you dig a hole in your mulch pile or in your beds and just drop the thing in, pot and all, and then the spring you just pull it out of the ground, pot and all, and then you decide where to plant it.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I just couldn't quite get to all the gardens this fall to get them in the ground, so I thought, well, I better do something with them to preserve them over the winter.
You're talking to someone who sees the unplanted daffodils looking forlornly at him every time he walks onto his front porch. And I go, look, boys, I dragged the birds of paradise in for the winter. I'm sorry I couldn't get to you.
Yep. Okay. I hear you.
all gardeners have guilty consciences, Jeff, especially this time of year.
For sure. For sure. That's absolutely.
All right. Well, good luck, sir.
All right. Thanks a ton. I love your show.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Bye.
All right. As promised, it is time for the question of the week, which we are calling Grass Wars, Bermuda versus Fescue in Virginia. As a special treat this week, we have a guest star to read the question of the week with me, Alexis Landis, who occasionally produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, has decided to grace us with her presence this week.
Hey, hey, not fair, not fair.
I've met you before, haven't I?
Yeah. Let's keep it moving.
All right, get it started.
Dennis in Vienna, Virginia writes, is there any sure way to kill the Bermuda grass that has taken over about 70% of my tall fescue lawn?
Well, of course it can be killed, but then you'd have less than one-third of a lawn left, which is not a good plan. Now, the devil is always in the details, so we followed up to ask Dennis the basic cultural questions, whose answers always explain such a takeover. Who cuts the lawn? How high is it after they cut it? Who feeds the lawn? And with what?
Well, Dennis responds, I cut the lawn myself and keep it around 3 or 4 inches tall.
Okay. That's pretty close to perfect. Cool season grasses like fescue are going to thrive with a 3-inch cut, while scalping lower than that would favor intrusion by a warm season grass like Bermuda, which can tolerate a much shorter cutting height.
So, no help there. Dennis continues, for fertilizing and weed control, I use a service that applies 6 feedings a year? Yikes!
Ding, ding, ding. 6 feedings a year is only 4 feedings too many. Cool season grasses like Dennis's dearly departed fescue do best with 2 feedings a season. A light meal in the spring and a big feeding in the late summer, early fall. That spring feeding gets the grass ready for the stress of summer to come, and the fall feeding helps the grass recover from that summer stress. If you feed a cool season grass in the heat of summer, it'll burn up, especially if the food is a high-powered salt-based chemical nitrogen. And you know, come to think of it, that many feedings has to be illegal in Virginia.
Actually illegal?
Yeah, several years ago, both Maryland and Virginia enacted legally binding restrictions on the amount of fertilizer that can be applied to a lawn and the timing of those applications. Basically, fertilizers can only deliver around 9 pounds of nitrogen per 1,000 square feet of turf, can only be applied twice a year, and can't be applied between November and March when the grass wouldn't be able to utilize the fertilizer and all of it would get washed into the bay.
Are these laws designed specifically to protect the Chesapeake Bay?
Absolutely. The laws also prohibit the use of any phosphorus unless a soil test shows that it's absolutely necessary, as phosphorus is the fertilizer most devastating to these kinds of waterways.
Well, I wonder if people actually obey the laws.
Probably not. Many don't even know about them. But they should know and they should obey them. Because if you follow the guidelines these laws establish, you'll both protect the bay and have a much better looking lawn. Overfeeding any kind of grass is as bad for the turf as overfeeding is for people and pets. In the case of turf grass, overfeeding leads to massive buildups of thatch, as well as increased pest and disease problems. And again, if you feed a cool season lawn like bluegrass or fescue in the summer, it'll severely stress the grass. But it will also fuel the growth of warm season grasses like Bermuda and warm season weeds like crabgrass. You do look familiar. I've seen you around here before.
Okay, so what can Dennis do now?
Well, Bermuda is a perennial lawn grass that many people use. It's also a very aggressive spreading grass. So if Dennis does nothing, which is often my favorite option in gardening, that Bermuda will take over the remaining 30% of the lawn by, say, August of next year. Then Dennis will have a one-grass lawn that's relatively easy care, as Bermuda loves D.C. area summers and fills in its own bare spots. Because it is a warm season grass, however, he would reduce the cutting height a bit and only feed in the late spring and midsummer. You don't feed warm season grasses like Bermuda in the fall.
And if he instead wants his fescue back?
Ooh, a lot of work lies ahead, if fescue it must be. And any herbicide that would kill Bermuda grass would also prevent any success with new turf. So Dennis is going to have the old turf removed with a sod cutter. If he does this in the spring, he could then install a turf-type tall fescue sod in its place.
Sod is more expensive than seed, but you get an instant lawn, right?
Absolutely. If he's going to sow a new fescue lawn by seed, he would remove the old turf in July and August, have a truckload of compost spread over the bare surface, and then spread the new fescue seed between mid-August and mid-September.
And how do we prevent the return of the Bermuda?
Eternal vigilance and proper lawn care. Fescue is a great grass. It grows slowly, handles lots of foot traffic, and doesn't require nearly as much food or water as bluegrass. But as we have been stressing, it's a clumping grass that can't spread to fill in the inevitable bare spots. So you have to overseed it at least every couple of years, and you would do that in mid-August to mid-September, too.
And the one thing I hear from you every week, be sure you have matching seed.
Exactly right. Make sure you start with a seed or sod that has a brand name and a specific variety indicated. And use that exact same seed when you have to make repairs, or you could wind up with a patchwork quilt instead of a unified turf. Well, that sure was some great information about grass now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes! My producer is threatening to falter my fescue if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live if you expect an answer. And or visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org. where you'll find the answers to all those questions you were going to send us, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. We continue to send get well wishes to Elizabeth Perez Luna, executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter continues to play our theme song. Our parole officer, Sweet Staven Naomi Sterobin, is leaning towards an indictment. Our indicted engineer is Al Banks. Our social media director, Amanda McGrath, has never been convicted of a federal crime. Assisting the authorities with their inquiries are webmasters Larissa Sapko and Rich Banowitz. Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia whenever she feels like it. Our head chairman, associate producer of Production Association is Brett Rader. Our intern is Robert Fogarty, who has class at Temple today. Manning the phones, or perhaps womaning the phones in his place, is our social media director, Amanda McGrath. Penn State's finest, Al Banks, is our editor. I'm your wise old Al, Mike McGrath, and if I didn't get arrested back then, I sure won't now. So just let me slip quietly past this dragoon dragnet, and I'll see you next week. He went that way, officer. He's the short, heavyweight, tall, skinny guy down there. I've already hit one, run one over, and the rest are eating my azaleas. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll try and deal with what seems to be a deluge of dangerous deer. Plus your fabulous phone calls.